So these are someone's glasses, aren't they? Now, I wonder who those are. Maybe they're allowed. You use
maybe
them if you want
to help you with the stage lights.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible.
Have you got any water?
I don't. I just had a couple of coffees and a fizzy water. So I think if I drank another one, my bladder would explode before we got off stage. But I might. See, it's kind of an experiment. There might be I think there's a doctor on the speaker list later. So maybe they could treat the kidney damage that resulted from drinking too much.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I guess we should get going.
You're the old hand now.
Yeah, I know. That's funny, actually. I felt very, and now I kind of, yeah.
Take me through the circle, Virgil.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you feel that you're represented by your Google, by your Google presence?
Actually, I want to go back one and talk about specialization and the academy and so on, because I'm in an interesting position. My parents are both the first people in their families to become literate, really. My dad was born in a refugee camp in Azerbaijan. My mom's father dropped out of school when he was 12 to work to support the family when his father died. And they both have PhDs. And it was really important to them that I go to uni. And I, as a result, I dropped out of 4 undergraduate programs without ever graduating or taking a degree. And then proceeded to change careers every 3 years ever since I was about 21. And each career that I changed into is one that didn't exist when I started the previous one. So that it's not like I could have gotten a degree in it. And I like to think of myself as sort of a dilettante, you know, 1 inch deep and 10 miles wide. And the uni, and it seems like a pretty good way to be in the 21st century in which things are changing all the time. And the academy completely fails to come to grips with this. So I spent a year teaching at the University of Southern California in the Center for Public Diplomacy as a Fulbright scholar. And, you know, advising grad students, undergrads, PhD candidates. And I was incredibly appalled by the extent to which they had specialized and the year in which they had specialized, because they go into secondary school, which in the States goes from 14 to 17. And they want to go to a top school. And in order to get into a top school, you have to have top marks all the way back to your grade 9 year. And because that's what distinguishes you, because it used to be you only needed top marks in your final year, and then everybody had top marks in their final year, so they said, well, and in your penultimate year, and so it's pushed back to get into the top schools. Well, one consequence of this is that nobody does anything that they won't get a top grade in. So you go in at 14 going, well, I'm good at literature, and I'm all right at maths, but I'm rubbish at history. I just won't take those courses. And so you do 4 years of that, then you graduate, and you get into a top school like USC, where you're paying $50,000 a year to attend in fees, not including your living expenses. More importantly, your parents are paying this. And they're quite adamant that you finish school in 4 years. And so you're appointed an advisor. This is one of the services that the school provides to students and their parents. And that advisor ensures that you, although your course theoretically consists of some core courses and then some electives, that you don't elect to do anything that's outside your discipline. Because again, you want to be graduating in 4 years. And the most disastrous possible outcome is for you to show up, spend 3 years in the literature program, take a physics course, and realize that physics is the thing that you wanted to do, and start over again, because now you're a 7-year degree man, right? So then you go on to grad school. And again, you've got 2 years to go through your master's program, and they want to get you in and out of there as quickly as possible. And then, so you do that, and then you become a PhD candidate, and the last thing they want is a bunch of all but dissertation PhDs hanging around like a bad smell for 9 years soaking up grant money. And so again, you're once again streamed into this. And so from 14 to about 26, if you do the full ride, you don't take any intellectual risks at all, right? The entire period during which you're supposed to be branching out and expanding, the period before brain plasticity begins to erode, you know, this period in which you're supposed to be eclectic and kind of 10 miles wide and 1 inch deep, you were in fact shoved down a canyon that's so deep you can't see the sky from it. And then you go out, and the expectation is that you will then find a career that'll support you in the rest of your life, and you find yourself essentially an auto worker in the age of the collapse of the auto industry, having 11 years of exquisitely turned expertise to do it, and nothing to do. And what do? You go back to school.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I lived in America for a couple of years, and I was very impressed by the fact that people really did think, though. I mean, that at all ages, one of my colleagues was 45, and he went back to school. He quit the job, which was very well paid, and he said, I'm going to get another degree. I want more out of this. And that I was so impressed with the North American attitude toward. I mean, there's a, despite what you say about those institutions in North America, they're far superior than the ones in Europe, I would say, in terms of the education they give. And they do at least give you the choice to do a physics, you know, right. If you're doing a liberal arts degree. I mean, you can't do that here at all.
Well, 20 years ago, when I was a secondary school student in Canada, it was considered very eclectic. You were allowed and encouraged to be eclectic. And I went through state-funded alternative schools where we were really very eclectic indeed. And we just, we really could faff for 7 years doing all kinds of different bits and pieces and then go on to uni and do this. And because there was so much subsidy, it was actually possible to do it. And I think in the States, people who have kind of lower expectations, who are willing to go to a state school, if you're from a state, if you're from Michigan and you go to Michigan State University, your fees are very low, and it's much easier to get in as well. So I think that there's some of that as well. We're confronting this now because my wife's British and we have a baby, and she's only 19 months old, but of course we're already thinking about her university education. And one of the things that we're confronted by here is that really at about 14 you start to specialize towards your university, even though it's not in the same way that it is in the States. You're figuring out what exams you're going to take at 14. Yeah, at 16 when you're 14, and the exams you take really determine what kind of school you'll get into and so on. And, you know, there's a famous, for better or for worse, science fiction writer named Robert A. Heinlein, who's done some wonderful and terrible things, but one of his great aphorisms is, specialization is for insects.
And, I like it.
And I don't think that's ever been more true. And partly, I think the role of the specialist historically has been to have a lot of facts at your disposal. It's not the synthetic, it's not merely the synthetic capacity of an expert to go, I've considered this abstruse fact and this abstruse fact and combine them in this novel way, but rather to simply have facts at your disposal. But the price of facts has crashed, right? In the era of Google, to come back to your first question, in the era of Google, the price of discovering any specific fact has gone through the floor, right? We now have these massive outboard brains. Now, Google doesn't synthesize much for us, but Google does recall these things for us pretty flawlessly and effortlessly. And so we can abstract away from having to know a bunch of facts and move into this thing that, you know, we're I think, better suited to doing, which is synthesizing.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, in defense of specialists, I suppose, I would say this, that because the number of facts has gone exponentially large, and as we've kind of grown the body of knowledge, and because the body of knowledge has become more and more available to us, that it becomes a forest that is hard to navigate, and I suppose I feel that, I mean, I see that in my own work, is that, all right, so I'm academic, blah blah blah, teach research, and so I sit down and we're doing a project about taste at the moment, for instance, and I'm coming to the subject quite new because I haven't done taste before. I mean, I'm a materials expert, but I'm not a taste expert, and so is the project student, so we're coming to it. So, but the only difference between us is, I mean, she is no more intelligent or less intelligent than me. The only difference is I've been in the business, you know, 20 years or so, and she hasn't. So we both look at the same papers, and we both do this thing, and we talk about the subject. And actually, it isn't that I'm bringing facts to this, because I don't have specialized facts in it. It's that I am saying that's an important, and that's, I think that's important. And when we argue about this, and I, you know, I'm not saying that I'm always right, but anyway, I have more opinions than she does about this, and I feel certain and that sort of thing. and when I try and analyze, and then when we discuss where that certainty comes from, I don't know. And I there's a kind of hunchness. There's a kind of, I think this is a fruitful way to go. And the thing is, if you don't do that, you'll get nowhere, because actually, if you try to explore every single paper systematically in this area, it would take 3 or 4 years just to read them all. And of course, someone else.
At which point, there'd be 3 more years with papers.
Exactly. So, all right. So what specialism does is it gives you hunt. It gives you the ability somehow. Maybe it's an emotional thing, or it gives you the ability to take shortcuts. And I suppose, as the world gets more complex and as the world gets more full of information, finding people who can take shortcuts could be useful. I mean, you know, it's one useful thing.
So this is where interdisciplinarianism becomes, if that's a word, becomes so interesting and cool.
Yeah.
I was thinking as you were talking before about whether or not people in different disciplines interact. There's a wonderful historian of science named George Dyson, who's Freeman Dyson's son. I don't know if you've read any of his work. So he's made something of a career out of going through his dad's garage and looking at his papers.
Yeah.
And one of the most fascinating presentations he's given, you can find it on the web, his PowerPoint and his video, is a history of the Princeton Institute, which is where, to some approximation, modern computing was invented. And among it was an interdisciplinary institute. It had poets and so on. But among the researchers who were there at one point were Gödel, Einstein, and von Neumann. And he maps papers published and breakthroughs made to shuffles in offices and to whose office who the various researchers needed to walk past in order to get from where they were to where they were going. And one of the other things he does is he maps some of the natural antagonism between the disciplines. So the poets were outraged that the scientists ate all the sugar, took all the sugar for their tea. There is a string of ever more angry memos, and disappointingly, not written in blank verse or anything, from the poetry department to the head of the Princeton Institute, just livid that the engineers are using up all the sugar and not replacing it. It's fantastic.
It's funny you should say that about food. It's like I feel like it's such an important part of thinking, and I think it gets completely overlooked. And maybe that's just my own personal way, but so our university recently redid the cafeteria, and it did it in a way that kind of made it more kind of swish and beautiful and everything, but it didn't make it in a way that you can actually sit down and have a bit of peace and quiet while eating your dinner. So it's really kind of open plan, and it's kind of really noisy, and it feels like really vibrant, and this is university, and everyone's here doing their stuff. But you can't think for toffee in there. Whereas before, I felt like, I don't know, there are these things, like having dinner with someone or having a lunch with someone, and actually you kind of... What is it about doing something over food or the tea, like having tea in the afternoon? These institutes, I think, was one of the things that in the Princeton Institute they did, didn't they? They had these kind of 4 o'clock teas, mm-hmm. and everyone would assemble as if they couldn't make their own tea. I mean, it was just impossible that these people could make their own tea. And now, I mean, in the university, everybody does make their own tea. Everyone sits in their own office and has their own tea. And I wonder if these tiny little institutional changes could hold back, you know, the process of intellectual, you know.
Well, this is getting into Jane Jacobs territory, right? I mean, if you build houses such that the people who live in them don't have cause to interact, right? If they don't have abutting terraces, if they don't have yards that they can see each other off over the back fences, if their houses are set back from the curb so that they don't see each other when they walk past, you social alienation begins, right? So Jacobs does a really wonderful job documenting this, and you can see it in the kind of the kinds of buildings that persisted in London and the kinds of buildings that were replaced and the ones that are loved and the ones that are loathed. And you really do have in London and through most of Europe this like Neubauten, Altbauten split where, you know, you just have this like total contempt for high rises and this incredible kind of romanticization of anything brick and semi-detached, you know? It's just fantastic. Mm. Never mind that there isn't a single right angle in the whole thing, and that it looks like it was built by mad wasps out of mud. It's just wonderful, you know? And the thing that is wonderful about it is the social interaction of the people who live there. And the shape of the box determines a lot about what goes inside it, to return to materials here.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what I was going to say. But, I mean, if you coming back to your disgust with the kind of the academy. I mean, so presumably after your teaching exploits, you kind of washed your hands of it.
No, I'm back. I'm a visiting lecturer at OU and at the University of Waterloo. So I've got six students.
Why do you do this? You hate this so much. You think it's worthless. You think the whole institution...
I don't think it's worthless. I think that it's problematic. But one of the most exciting things that happened when I was at USC was meeting students who wanted to get out of it. In fact, in some ways, having such a tight constraint on students made the students who chafed against it much more visible, right? They really stood out. And I walked away from it. You know, I said to my students, you know, technically, I need you to produce a final project to do this. And I think most of the profs on campus are going to ask you to write an essay. But let's be honest with each other. You don't want to write the essay. I don't want to read the essay. And when we're done, no one else is ever going to look at the essay. So. If you want to write an essay, go ahead and write an essay. But if you want to do something else, I'll consider anything. Just talk to me about it. So one of my students founded a Creative Commons record label that's still going and going incredibly well. Mm. And I had three or four students who just kicked it right out of the field that way. And so that was unbelievably rewarding. I call them my my botnet, right? I had this kind of zombie army that I could farm interesting stuff out to, because that's the other thing is a lot of my students went on to work at civil liberties organizations that I'd had some peripheral or central association with, whom now when I get queries over the transom, you know, can you help me with this problem? I can go, I can't, but I have a student who's now employed at the Electronic Frontier Foundation who'd be glad to take that on board for you, who draws a salary for doing it. So that was really productive, and it's always nice to have that. Also, because I'm a science fiction writer, and science fiction as a discipline has always been, or as an industry, I guess, has always been really focused on mentorship relationships and a real collegial feeling. I kind of feel like I need to pay some...
I don't know about that.
Partly, I think, if you go back to the earliest days of the science fiction writerdom, you have these... first of all, you have an extreme porosity between science fiction readership and writership. The fan-writer split is very, very porous. They go to the same parties, they hang out together, there's a mutual respect and so on, and people move freely back and forth between those membranes. You know, you have these writers who are like titans of the field, like Bradbury and Silverberg and Ellison and so on, who started off writing, you know, mimeograph zines. Actually, not mimeograph, because they predate the mimeograph. They were hectographed zines. And they're now, you know, towering giants of the field. And a lot of them were actually like kind of proto-polyamorous hippies. So there are these group houses like the Futurian House in New York, where writers like Damon Knight and Kate Wilhelm and so on all lived together and, you know, sort of shagged each other and wrote stories under each other's names, and kind of, they were beyond collegial. They were communal. And that ethic just seems to have pervaded the field. So anyway, I was mentored by wonderful and amazing writers who really, really took me under their wing, many of whom are still alive and are now colleagues. And that it feels like I have an obligation to carry on that norm too. So my Waterloo students are all writing. They're all writers. So I'm working with them on writing. My OU students, less so, more in the computer program. So yeah, there's some of that too.
I have a question about science fiction, okay? Because I'm one of these people who I love science fiction, but I'm not expert in it. I mean, I kind of dip into it, and one of the things that really puzzles me is why it isn't more part of the kind of main cultural canons of literature these days. Is that right?
It's funny. When I was growing up, my dad. Actually, more my grandparents used to tell me stories about anti-Semitism, and partly because they were immigrants from Eastern Europe to Canada, and there was still they stood out, you know, and so on. I never experienced it firsthand. They would tell me these. It was like hearing about witch burning. And when I was a young man entering the field, my mentors would tell me about the institutional prejudice against science fiction. I have never once experienced it. Okay. Actually, once when I went to York University when I was a high school student to see whether I would go to their interdisciplinary program. And they said, so what are you interested in? And I enumerated all the things that I was doing, programming computers and activism and writing science fiction. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, writing science fiction. We have a wonderful creative writing program. Let me call up the head of the creative writing program right now and see what they can offer to science fiction writers. And mm-hmm. I could hear the other side of the conversation. I'm a young man in my office who's a science fiction writer. I'd like to know about. And the guy cut him off right there and he said, we only teach literature here.
Right.
But it's like the one time in my life anyone has ever discriminated against me for writing science fiction. Every other time, it's been, you know, when I started a software company in 99, as you do, and raised like $14 million in the capital markets. And as I was stumping up and down Sand Hill Row in Northern California, in Silicon Valley, going to these venture capitalist offices, I would say, well, you know, we've invented this open source search engine, and I write science fiction. And they go, science fiction? Really? Can you tell me more about writing science fiction? I've always wanted to write science fiction. Who do you know? Have you ever met Robert Heinlein and so on? And then they would go, oh, and incidentally, tell me about your technology. I mean, I would get more FaceTime with these VCs than like any other entrepreneur stumping up and down Silicon Valley because I was a science fiction writer. The number of doors it's opened. I've landed at the American airports because, you know, I'm a Canadian, so whenever I enter the States, it's always very fraught. I'm often going there to give a compensated lecture, and the immigration status of that is very confusing. And I meet these customs officers, and they go, what do you do? And I say, oh, I write science fiction. Oh, really? Mm. You write science fiction? Tell me all about it. So I guess somewhere out there, there's someone who thinks that science fiction is unimportant, trivial, or not worth taking note of. I have never met that person.
Yeah, but I mean, when you describe all those moments, it does. I mean, yeah, I would understand that. I think that because it is fascinating science fiction, and I think the anniversary of the moon landings this year really brought out that sense of wonder and excitement about the frontiers of space and the future and what's out there. And there is a genuine excitement that I feel in everybody about that. But to get into that club of the classics seems to be a completely different.
You mean like? Are you talking about the Shakespearean canon?
I just don't know.
I guess
inside, it's so, in my area. In order to get into those things, it's quite straightforward. You have to make a major discovery and get a Nobel Prize. Right. In fact, the wackier the discipline, the better. The more modern, the better. The more new, the better.
Right.
There's no sense in which doing something that in the past in the same way is going to get you anywhere. And it just seems to me that in literature somehow that isn't the case. But you're telling me it's not.
I think that there's, first of all, that we have to understand that there's really two science fiction literatures at least. One is the cinematic or televisual one, and the other one is the prose one. And the cinematic televisual one is, I think, largely an aesthetic genre. The writing is almost incidental. And certainly the internal consistency of those stories doesn't hold together. I mean, you think about the Star Trek universe, and if you had faster than light travel and the capacity to assemble matter from stored patterns in a computer, you'd never send a spaceship abroad. You'd send something the size of a football that would have like a transporter and a faster-than-light radio, and it would go into orbit around a planet, and you beam down 37 copies of the most competent crewman in the entire Starfleet, who would in fact be sitting at home watching telly on Earth, and they would go off and have an adventure. If any of them died, you'd just bring new copies of them down, and then when you're done, you'd annihilate them all back into the database, right? I mean, the ship is it doesn't hold
you
together.
You thought this through, haven't
oh,
you?
Yeah, yeah. But in the literature... Although I think even the writers sometimes think that they're prognosticators, that it's a predictive literature, what it mostly is a descriptive literature of the way that we're coming to grips with technology today, from Shelley onwards. So Mary Shelley was not concerned with the animation of flesh with lightning. Mary Shelley was concerned with the impact that technology was having on humanity and the thought that humanity might get away from us. There are people who try to say that Frankenstein is just another Golem story. But the Golem story isn't a story about technology, and the Frankenstein story is. Mm. It is, I think, a watershed. And you can write about any moment in time. You don't have to write about the future to write science fiction. So Neal Stephenson has this wonderful System of the World trilogy, which is about the discovery of the calculus. It's a brilliant, gripping science fiction trilogy, 3,000-page science fiction trilogy about Isaac Newton discovering calculus. William Gibson has started writing novels set the year before they come out. So his last one came out in 07, it was set in 06. It was one of the most futuristic books I'd ever read, because what he's doing is seeing the forest for the trees. He's finding those telling moments about how we relate to technology and how it's changing our lives that are completely eye-opening, that are these aha moments. And you can really do that about any period.
Yeah, I mean... So one of my favorites is Douglas Adams. Mm-hmm. And when I say to people, oh, Douglas Adams, that science fiction writer, mm-hmm. people say he's not a science fiction writer. And I'm like, well, if he's not a science fiction writer, well, he wasn't. What was he? Because, and in the end, they come to that because he's really good.
Well, there is that.
That's what they kind of
but
say.
Special pleading. Do you know what I mean? Okay, so special
and you're
pleading.
Like, whoa. I mean, that is prejudice there then, right?
Well,
I mean,
yeah, but special pleading is a hazard comment to many people. I mean, T.S. Eliot, might have been a terrible anti-Semite, but he loved Groucho Marx, right? And they had this very warm correspondence. And basically, between the lines, it's like, you're not really a Jew, So there is everybody's got this moment where they're like, oh, well, you're rather white Jew, you know? It's not really science fiction, Douglas Adams. I mean, Douglas Adams, it's funny you should mention, because I was just listening to the radio plays again. And on a sentence-by-sentence level, Douglas Adams was unbelievably funny. Against any writer in any genre, he was unbelievably funny, in the top sort of five, I think. And I think that in that sense, he was a humorist. More than he was anything else, he was a humorist. Certainly, he wasn't much of a predictor. He was a very keen observer of our relationships with technology, but he wasn't a predictor in any way, and he was very, very funny.
What do you mean by predictor?
Well, he wasn't trying to. He didn't even have the pretense to be predicting anything in our near future. Some of it is very good allegory and explicit allegory, right? There's that the bulldozer's coming for your house, the aliens are coming for your planet, allegorical as above, so below bit. But a lot of it was just funny observational stuff about technology. It was, in fact, it was kind of like if Jerry Seinfeld stood up and did a show entirely about technology, a show about nothing, just observational humor. Do you ever think about telephone sanitizers? You know, there is that whole subplot in Douglas Adams about telephone sanitizers being, on the one hand, useless, overblown tits, and on the other hand, when they eliminate them all, everybody dies due to a telephone transmitted plague. You know?
Tell me more about your interest in science. Then, do you kind of do you sort of avidly read the latest? I mean, how do you keep up to date?
I write for Nature sometimes, and I do. I listen to the Nature podcast. I listen to the Quirks and Quarks podcast, which is the Canadian radio science show, and to the NPR Science Friday. So that's my kind of my daily or weekly dose, sort of 3 hours of science radio. And then I read the Science Daily News, and which is a good newswire. It's kind of it's like PR newswire for scientific discovery. And Seed Magazine. You know Seed Magazine? Scienceblogs.com.
No.
So Seed Magazine's like at the politics of science. Very good journal. And they're involved with that. So to that extent, I'm kind of engaged with it. My other area of engagement with it is through the open access movement. So as a kind of advocate for a more liberal view of copyright. I find a special interest in the academy and sciences, particularly science, particularly because if you're not telling people how you do it and letting them try, it's not science. It may be interesting, it may be productive, but science by definition requires publication, disclosure, and review. And to the extent that you have intermediaries like Elsevier inserting themselves between scientists to the detriment of access, you are actually eroding the mission of science. And so with creative artists, you can say, well, it's the reason that a creative artist should be sharing her work is because it's nice, it may make you more money, it may make you more widely known, and so on. But it's hard to say that you have a moral obligation to make your work available on an open access term. But to a scientist, I think there is a strong case to be put that says, if you are not sharing your work as broadly as possible, you have ceased to do science. You may be doing research, you may be in industry, even if you're in a university, but you're not a scientist anymore. You're not adhering to the method. So that's, I think, my main interest in science.
Do you think that's, I mean, potentially revolutionary in the sense that, I mean, you're talking about the fact that most science gets published in journals, which you have to have a subscription for. And if you're not part of a university and you haven't got a couple of £1,000 to spare, you're not going to...
50,000, 70,000,
yeah,
depending on the
journal. It does depend, yeah. And there's this new growing movement which you're a part of, which is about let's get the raw science as it comes out of the lab and we'll put it straight on the web because that's what the web is really good at and let's just let everyone see it. Exactly. Now, I've submitted two of my papers to open access journals and the one thing I was shocked at is how much it cost me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had this kind of weird idea that it was going to be free.
Right.
And it was £2,000
yeah.
to publish my journal. So in a sense... It seemed to me that although on the face of it looks very revolutionary, but then when you look at what actually it means to you is that you have to pay to essentially be this, to put it out there.
What you have to think about there is there being only one payer, right? We often say with tax, there's only one taxpayer. So if you move some responsibility into the councils and off the national government, the same people end up paying for it. There's no net savings. By the same token, if you say to an institution, we're going to take £50,000 a year for the Journal of Abstruse Neuropathology out of your budget and give it back to you, but we're going to require that for the 7 papers a year that your institution produces that you pay £14,000 for peer review, that is a net gain of £36,000 to the institution. However, because of the way that the budget lines are drawn, it's often the case that the researchers are expected to contribute out of their research budget, whereas the savings in the journal budget is treated as a windfall that doesn't get returned to the researchers. But I put it to you that that's an institutional problem. It's not a failure of the open access movement. That the bottom line is that an open access institution is always saving money on an institution wide basis, and that money can be better spent on science.
But how do we get? I mean, I take that. But how do you get to the point where? There's two potential problems. One of which is just that you're then going to have to ration. You're going to have to, you know, once you start it being a certain amount of money per paper, you're rationing how much you put out there, because you can only afford, even if they give us the budget, I'll only be able to put so many papers out there. And maybe that's a good thing, actually. I mean, that might mean that I publish less and think about it more clearly. But the other thing is that there's in order for this to happen, in order for this really become open access, and for the internet to actually change the way that science works, which would be amazing, you have to change these institutions. I guess we're back to the beginning again, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Like these institutions, which we call universities, are very bizarre things. They're old. Like old kind of gnarly animals, and they're not easily changed, and they're modified by many different people. I mean, do you have a sense in which that change can happen? How does that happen? Because PLOS, for instance, they've managed to do it through government funding, essentially. I mean, they've just
No, mostly foundation funding.
Okay, foundation. Yeah.
Public Library of Science. Yeah. Which, so I guess I want to step back and say that the risk that you've identified is a pretty attenuated risk at this stage. There's no one who's yet run up against that limit where they're finding that they have to ration their discoveries. Certainly, it's not hard to imagine that if there were a truly groundbreaking discovery and no budget left, and what it wanted was 2,000 quid for peer review, that if every single scientist in your field was reading what you were publishing on your blog and going, holy moly, this is the most interesting thing that's happened to material science since, you know, carbon nanotubes, that it wouldn't be hard to find £2,000 somewhere to go, if not PLOS just waiving their fee. I mean, this is a pretty attenuated risk. As to how you change institutions, it's a better question. I think that what's happening in the research journals is, in fact, a signal of a giant institutional shift. There is a huge change in the way that scientists are thinking about science as a result of the open access movement. And so I think that'll start to permeate through the rest of the institution. I don't know by what path it'll take, but I think it's bound to take that path.
I mean, and do you think that essentially, how will that affect, does any of this have any bearing on science fiction? I mean, are they completely unrelated, both in the way that you, in the way that who you are and what you do? Like, on the one hand, you're doing something that's very political and actually very significant in that sense. On the other hand, presumably your writing is a form of self-expression. But are they somehow linked?
Yeah, well, so this is great. Collection of essays by a writer named E.L. Doctorow, who is probably not related to me, or if he is, it's like, you know, as much consanguinity as any two Eastern Europeans have, but no more. It's called The Creationists, and it's a series of essays on people who've created wonderful things. And it starts with an essay on the Babylonians who wrote the Genesis myth. And it ends with an essay about the Los Alamos Project. And in between, it's mostly about writers. It's about Herman Melville and Edgar Allan Poe and several other writers. And he draws a beautiful thread through them, through all of these things, as a form of creativity and expressiveness. And I think that science is very expressive. And in fact, a science conference and a science fiction convention are not vastly different. I mean, it really is the same badly socialized beardy weirdies wearing t-shirts with things that nobody understands. Mm. I mean, it really is.
And lots of beards.
Yeah.
It always struck me that science fiction has often been the inspiration for science, and that relationship is, I mean, there's huge.
Bidirectional,
too. Yeah, exactly. But that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, do you actually interact with scientists? I mean, are they part of this mentoring that you talk about, or your community?
Well, there are some scientists in the field, right?
Yeah,
You know, Jeff Landis, who's a very well-known science fiction writer, also designed part of the Mars Lander, and so on. You know, but I guess, yeah. I mean,
why don't science
fiction
writers come to my conference, for instance?
There probably are some.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. They don't say it if they do. They're undercover.
But you know, so like Science Foo, SciFoo, which is Nature's unconference at the Google campus, is packed with science fiction writers as well as scientists. NASA and there's a science fiction trust here in the UK. Both have a program whereby they bring scientists in contact with astrophysicists and space scientists to get the science right for space travel. Mm. I think one of the reasons, when we talk about space, that scientists and science fiction writers have had little to say to each other is that the science of space travel is bunkum, right? All science fiction stories about space travel are absolute bunkum. I mean, the bottom of the ocean and the middle of the Gobi Desert are infinitely more hospitable and useful to us as human beings than the moon will ever be. And yet, we have no earthly use for, literally, no
earthly use.
That's
the allure of it, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, I met an astronaut. It was one of my great moments in my life. I met him, and he'd been on the moon, and I just wanted him to tell me, and he was so unable to convey it to me. And he said, what should we do next time we go to the moon? And he said, send poets.
Yeah.
Because I cannot tell you what it feels like. I just don't have the way to express myself. But believe you me, he said, it's worth sending the poets.
I've got something cool for you. Space smells like gunpowder. The smell of the inside of a space helmet is apparently gunpowder, and it's what happens when it's a material science thing. It's what happens when you expose the materials that are used on the interiors of those helmets to extremes in temperature differential and the vacuum on the outside and so on. So apparently all the astronauts say space smells like gunpowder.
Oh, well, yeah. That is, it's always been one of my ambitions to go into space, and there are, these days it seems like not an unrealistic one.
Although I get motion sick, and I'm also afraid of heights, so I have no ambition to go into space. My wife wants to go to space.